What's up, Peter? I got the sniffles.
Are you sick? It's the time of year.
No. I haven't gotten sick yet this year.
Nice. What have you changed?
I'm N equals four in New York.
Nice.
So I've become immune to all diseases.
You stopped eating pizza off like the ground on the subway. It's like your big change from last year.
Well, no. Well, that's what made me so strong. I acquired all the immunities. They really should, you know, you like joining. You want to become a SEAL, and like stage one is just living in New York for 3 years. You become like, you have like the strongest autoimmune system in the world after that. Nice. No disease can stop you. I was in the coast of Morocco, but it doesn't matter because I lived in New York City for 3 years. Today, I want to talk about a conversation that I had over the last week or two with a few different people. So kick it off. It started with chatting with a buddy of ours. He was working with a Vue developer, and they were talking about building a new SPA. And they were talking about data, getting data into it, and basically the patterns there. And, you know, he is an Ember developer, and so he's more familiar with, you know, building Ember apps and how we do things in a conventional Ember app with Ember data, where, you know, like we always talk about, you have your identity map, you read a graph of data in. Everything in Ember and Ember data is built around that idea where you have conventional endpoints and they're dumb. Your API is basically a dumb data layer. And then you read it in, and all your logic, as much of your business logic as possible, is on the client. He was transitioning away from doing as much development to doing more management. And so he was, and they were also using Vue, which he is not like super familiar with, right? But it's a lot of the same ideas, building an SPA basically. So the guy he was working with was setting up some of the foundations for the data stuff for this new application. And the approach he was taking was a little different than that. Actually, it was very different. The idea was actually flipping that. Instead of having a dumb data layer for your API, you actually end up putting a lot of business logic in your API. And then the client app, in this case a Vue app, is dumb and just renders what's given from the API. So the example he used was like, let's say you have a homepage of a to-do application, and you have three to-dos that are saved in the database, and then you have one blank one that's like, click here to add a new to-do. You know, like you could think of like an empty Trello card. And if we were doing that in Ember, we would think of that as client-side state, since it's non-persistent. And so that empty Trello card would be like store.createRecord card, and it wouldn't exist in the server. The API wouldn't know about that at all. Because like you can imagine that changing a lot, and you wouldn't want to have to change the API to change that part of the UI.
Yeah, I mean, like I create a new card, I cancel it. I create a new card, I cancel it. I create a new card, I cancel it. I don't want my server to know about any of that.
Exactly. Whereas this guy was doing the opposite, where the Vue app remains kind of dumb and just renders what comes from the database, or from the API in this case. And so it knows how to render like a blank to do. So we were talking about that and thinking that's kind of weird. And he was saying this guy was insisting that this is kind of the conventional way to do things in Vue.
Can I ask a question here? Mm-hmm. When you say like it knows how to render a blank to do, is that, does like the server respond with something that just says like, hey, here's the shape of a blank to do? Or does the server say like, hey, I've inserted like a new to do in the database. All its values are like empty string or null.
I don't even think that. I think it's the first thing where it's not even representing something that's in a database. It's like if you're going to add some logic here, you're going to update your API to include that logic. And it's just going to be like client side. It's just going to be display logic. It's not persistent state.
Okay.
So again, like very opposite from how we would do things, how we would recommend doing things. Because it's just for all sorts of reasons. But this guy was kind of insisting that this is the way to do it, like the conventional approach. And, you know, my friend was kind of confused about that. So that was just one of the things that came up in this conversation we were having. So then I actually reached out to Adam Wathen, because I know he does a lot of Vue development, and was like, just as a pulse check, like, is this how things are done in the Vue community? Because I was really surprised by this. And I know they have VueX as like a state management solution. And I just imagined that everyone's kind of doing the same things that we are. And you have a conventional, you know, endpoints in your API that can be read into an identity map. Basically, it looks like the result of like a select star statement from SQL. more or less your API looks like that. Even if you're using GraphQL, like it's just data. It's not really this kind of lower level details that would be driving your user interface wouldn't be part of your API. And Adam was saying he was kind of confused by it. You know, he was like, he wouldn't do it like that kind of if he had to just do something today. But he also was talking about, like, he doesn't really build SPAs. So he doesn't actually really, he was like, I don't really, it's not like I've been on a team building SPAs in Vue for 5 years. So he's maybe not the best person to speak to this, although he knows the patterns in the community. So he was kind of asking more about it and like asking what I meant when I said identity map and reading it, like having a dumb API layer. And he was like intrigued and interested, like how we do things. And so he was kind of asking like, oh, you know, let's say like you're creating a new sign up instead of like from the perspective of the application, there's one flow, which is like a user signing up and the backend is smart where it creates maybe a user and it creates an invitation and it sends an email. But the backend smart, the front end is just saying sign in this new user. And I was like, well, as much as possible, we strive to model everything in the front end and have all those things be triggered by the front end. So the backend's dumb and the front end is smart. And he was like, well, what about the things that like, he's like, you know, I've never done this myself, but I've always thought about with this approach. It's like, what about the things that only the server can do? And there's lots of things that only the server can do. Send emails, you know, subscribe to Stripe. And I was like kind of explaining our approach, right? And so ideally, let's say someone signs up and subscribes to EmberMap. You know, I was kind of talking through the reason you want all that stuff modeled is so that when it comes back to the front end, you just have the cache on the client that has all those models, and then you render from that cache. And this gives you more flexibility in the front end.
Right. And just as like an example that always bites me when I do put a ton of logic in the back end is that eventually you have one front end model that changes. The client knows about it because it changes on the front end. When you submit that change to the server is going to not only change that model, but there's some other logic that, oh, based on your change, I'm going to go update these five other records. And then now your front end basically needs to know that right. These five other records changed. And kind of like, unfortunately, with JSON API, we don't have a great way to send that data back to the client.
Right.
So then I've been on apps where, okay, now like the front end has to, basically the front end ends up knowing that, oh, I should go refresh these other right. models because they might have changed. And then now it's like, well, you tried to hide this logic in the back end, but it's leaking out.
Right.
It's leaking out in the right. front end. Or you do something where you start, you know, pumping new data in the submit response and the post request.
Right. Side loading it.
Side loading. But again, there's not really like a great convention for this.
Right.
So
this is kind of where the trajectory of the conversation, because on the one hand, I was like, oh, you want to model everything for exactly the reasons you just said. Like if the user email is sent, but that just happened as a result of the front end saying like get request to user / sign up and it doesn't know, but you're rendering somewhere else, like the user's last email was sent from the user model. You just want that model. You want it in your Ember data store. But then he's like, well, so how do you actually do that? And I was like, well, you know, if you have a action that does like three things, ideally you'd be able to like send a transaction with like the three things. And there's kind of ways you can fudge that right now. But you want to keep the server dumb. And then he was like, well, what about like a Stripe subscription, like creating a Stripe subscription? Like how can you, you know, there's secrets that you need your server to have that your client can't have, obviously. And you know, you can't model everything on the client and have, basically you can't have the backend be completely dumb. Like you're going to have to write the controller method.
Yes. I mean, this is something we've written the Stripe thing, but I still think our Stripe endpoint, our Stripe interaction, I consider that to be dumb because what happens is a front end basically says, hey, I'm going to make this payment. Here's my authorization that I, the front end, go out from Stripe to make this payment. I'm going to submit it to the backend and the backend's just going to go off to Stripe and say, okay, please charge this. And when it works, let me know. And then the backend, like, let's say that this charge was successful. The backend is going to send down a response that says, okay, I got your Stripe thing and it's successful. It's dumb. It's not like, hey, I created a new Stripe thing for you.
Right.
It's you told me a Stripe thing. I charged. Here's the state of it. you know, update your front end cache.
Right. It is dumb, but at the same time, it's not so dumb that if you open our code base, there's no code there. Whereas like for creating a video, there's no code. Let's say there's, yeah, there's yeah. a model that has no code there because it's literally a new database row that just has data there. And so it, the question really became like, what can be abstracted by JSON API resource? That's another way to ask the question.
Yep.
And then so you start looking through the app and you're in your mind, you're like, yeah, 90% of this stuff should be like this, right? And I was kind of talking to him about how like this is a really interesting way to work because, you know, when you put all your logic in the front end, you know, he was kind of saying like he's one of the reasons he's avoided doing SPAs is because of the complexity and he likes having it all in one spot. And I was saying, you know, we like to have all the complexity and logic in the front end because for the same reason, like in even using Mirage, it actually starts to make you think of the back end. You're right over there. You were thinking about like going back to PHP development or something.
Go ahead.
We're going to become PHP developers by the end of this episode. I was saying it's the same reason for us. We actually want all the data in the front end and the logic there because, you know, let's say we're writing tests with Mirage. We don't even have to think about the back end. Basically, when you start thinking about your app in this way, the back end almost becomes a commodity. It becomes something that can be almost replaced by a service like Firebase, right? And you're like, yeah, like this, it makes so much sense. Like 90% of our resources are very conventional. They're very declarative with like JSON API resources. And then there is an escape hatch there when you need it for things like Stripe or sending an email, but like it doesn't happen that much and the benefits are great, right? Mm-hmm. But then you actually look at our backend and you look at the controller code and it's like, where are the controller codes? Where is the controllers where we're actually able to not write anything? And then where do we have to write things?
I think this is largely driven from the JSON API spec. And when we need things that go outside the JSON API spec, it's like tons of code.
Pain.
Yeah, pain. Where if we have like one model and we're reading it and we're writing it, it's like no code, right?
Right.
That's like we can have like some super declarative resource right. and let the system take care of it. And it passes a Firebase test.
Right, exactly.
We could that's, just move this to
test.
Firebase.
Yeah. That is the test.
But then it's stuck.
But then you look at what actually, so let's say we were to actually move MMS back into Firebase. What would it actually look like? What would we still need? What would we need escape hatches for? Right. Because I was starting to talk through, again, there's like this theoretical thing. And then there's like when the rubber hits the road, what incidental complexity still exists in the architecture that we've chosen for this?
Yeah. So like anything that needs to come from us, just things that we need to verify that like, we can't have like the front end sending email on our behalf.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because that's like open for abuse.
Right. Exactly.
So... But these are things that like...
But the question is like, what's the percentage there? Like what needs to be done by us and therefore requires complexity and therefore the promise of the SPA starts to lose some of its luster. It starts to fall apart a little bit.
Okay. So let's, rather than me try to estimate, I would say like uploading things to S3,
right.
We can't just allow anyone to upload. So we create a signature... Think of that payload access to upload to S3. Emails, Stripe, auth. Mm-hmm. Those are the sort of things. But, you know, I think there's like a general case here and these things can be abstracted over.
Yeah.
I think you could have a Firebase that supports Stripe. And
right.
You say, you give me a Stripe token, and I'm going to make sure it gets charged.
I think they even do have, because he actually was asking about that. He was like, I just don't get it. Like, tell me how, if I was going to start a new Vue app, and use Firebase, how would I charge people? And there was like an entry on the Firebase docs about Stripe.
Very
so,
cool.
Yeah. So I think the reason I want to... Go ahead.
Yeah. I think where it falls apart and where our messy controller code, backend controller code exists is when we have to go outside of JSON API spec.
Right.
And unfortunately today, there's just...
Today there is...
You're building a real app there where the rubber meets the road. There's going to be a handful of cases, which we've talked about before.
Exactly. So the reason I wanted to talk about all this on the podcast was just because when I get in these conversations, you know, Adam's good because he's kind of not just taking my word for it. He's like, so what do you actually do? And I'm like, no, you know, you want all the data model in the front end, blah, 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 blah. And then you go and say, what does Ember Maps backend code base actually look like? And there's like lots of custom code and controllers. And you know, we've talked about this before, clients we've worked with in other situations where, you know, on the one hand, we kind of have this idea that, like we've said this before, like every web app should be an Ember app. And what we mean by that is there's a future where the capabilities that you're interested in building that can only be supported by a rich client-side app don't come at a cost of additional complexity when you want to build something like a landing page, right? The tooling, the conventions can get you there. So on the one hand, we have that belief. That's like a very strong belief of ours of why we continue to invest in Ember. But then the other hand, you have, you're talking to someone, they're going to build something tomorrow, and then what are you going to tell them? That's the question.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting, right? Because by the end of this conversation, it's like I hadn't convinced him that this was clearly a superior approach, even though it's how we're building every app today.
Can we say, like, you know, we do think every app should be an Ember app, but that doesn't mean that every app we're going to make is going to be an Ember app. You know what I mean? Like,
I think it's kind of like another way to say that is like, why do we continue? There's situations where you make a new Rails app and you're going to just dominate someone who has the architecture that we use.
Yeah.
Create a new Rails. Show me a video demo. We talked about this before. Show me a video demo of creating a new Ember app and setting up with authentication with a form that's validated.
Yeah.
The Rails.
I'm going through this right now on Ember map. I'm building this into our app and it's just like,
there's so many moving parts.
It's painful.
There's so much complexity. Not only do your validations on the client side, first of all, client side and server side, not only do those things exist and you're choosing your own libraries for it, 9 other senior Ember developers are going to do it slightly different. I mean, maybe you'll have 5 people do one way, 3 people do another, and then the other 2 do other way, something like that. But as this of 10 senior Rails developers, what is this going to look like? They're all going to use Devise, let's say, or maybe one of 2 libraries, and they're going to use Form4 and the validations on the model and the database layer, and they're going to be done before you've even installed CP validations or whatever, right? Not to mention like deploying 2 apps and having them talk to it, not to mention all that stuff, right? So I thought it was interesting because it's just like, yeah, you have that conversation and you're like, no, it's so powerful. Like, I promise you, I've seen the power and it's incredible. You have your data model in the client, gives you so many things to do, rendering, declared rendering from your client side cache. And it's incredible what it opens up, the capabilities on the web. And then by the end of that conversation, you're like, using 10-year-old technology, someone would like run a race around me. So there's a tension almost. And I think, again, the way I resolve this in my mind is like, there is a future where getting a login form with a user and validations in an Ember app with either Firebase or like a Rails API or whatever, Laravel API, whatever it is just as it should be. It is just as easy as using a full stack server side framework. But you now have the progressive enhancement of a one line install of Liquid Fire that gives you across route transitions, which is not possible with Rails.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, yeah, you have a way to organize, abstract, test your front end code.
Right.
Yes.
Then I started thinking what's interesting is like, what are the steps that are stopping us from getting there? Like, why aren't we there yet? And a lot of it, if you think about it, is like, yeah, it's like this incidental complexity. It's like people not agreeing about, let's say, the validations case. People just not agreeing, not having that built into like the standards, not having that be opinionated enough. A lot of the work that's going on in Ember is like low level stuff that is going to unlock things in the future. But there's a lot of this stuff that's just, what did someone say the way they put it? It's the middle class has been forgotten. I think that's such a good way to say it. There's the middle class of Ember app developers who are sitting around saying, why is it so hard to create a user sign-in form with validations? It's like the boring problems that have a solution that's not technologically, it doesn't need any new VM or it doesn't need any, it just needs people to agree in the same way that, you know, Form4 was just.
Yeah, active record.
Yeah, active record. You just choose what the validations look like, what the field names are, and then you get this Form4 view helper that gets you a validated form in like 2 lines of code.
Could you say like a part of this is like we're new at building these SPAs, not just us, but everyone. The world is new at building this type of app. And therefore, there's a lot of churn in the technology. So we thought it was something like remember like what was those like Hados, the discoverable API format, and then we moved to like JSON API, and then now everyone is moving to GraphQL. Mm-hmm. Is it just that as we build these apps, we discover new things, and therefore there's churn, and because of that churn, we're not going to be able to settle on hey, this is how you do validations. Because we can't even agree on how we should communicate with the back end and the front end. So how can we possibly build?
Well, one question I would have for you is like, how did this all go down in the Rails community? I mean, eventually you pull a trigger on something and then you test it out and then you improve it over time, right?
Rails had, 10 years of people building the same SQL app and...
Yeah, but like Form 4 wasn't always there and then it was added and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, yes, I do.
It's just like JSON API.
I do think that Rails has a lot more alignment on we're all in this together. We want to
serve the middle class.
Yeah. We want a common solution where like JavaScript doesn't feel that way. Ember doesn't even feel that way.
Right. In a lot of ways. Yeah. There's lots of areas where it's like not up to us to solve. I guess that's one question is like, and I feel like this is maybe not being solved by anyone. I mean, I guess I don't know because I haven't been a Vue developer for 3 years, but I assume based on what I hear about React, that if you were to do this, you would get wildly different answers from people. Also, like the people I follow, a lot of them like React because it doesn't get in their way. And so if you want to use Firebase and you ask them how to make a validated user sign-in form, they would just say, oh, you just do whatever makes sense. You can do it really quick because the conventions don't get in your way. Yeah. It's like super flexible, but that's not really what we're talking
about. Right, right, right. By the way, AWS does have just, I think, to look at some ways people are tackling this problem. It's not just AWS, but AWS does have like a toolkit for these sort of things. So similar to something like Firebase, but they actually have a user authentication system and they give you React components.
Mm.
So you can have a React component that's like user sign-in form component and get your sign-in like that.
But it's like almost like it's a provider. And
yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's like cool. You can render the UI.
You can render the UI. You can customize the UI. I think I saw like a demo where like people are using style components with it and renderless components.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
So that's like one way to kind of
take this out, remove this problem from the developer's problem space, like just have it delegated to a service.
But knowing where those boundaries of that service are, I think that's a difficult thing.
Yes.
And that we're kind of like, feeling in the dark. And,
right.
And that creates churn.
Right.
So.
But yeah, it's just interesting because like you want to be using the most productive tool, but then you also have a vision for where it's going to be at some point in the future, let's say. And like already, if you compare Ember today from Ember 4 years ago, you're so much closer to that vision. Like, There have been a lot of those promises have been realized. But if you were to actually have to sit down and build a new SaaS app, let's say that charges people with subscriptions, like what would that actually look like?
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. I think you have to look at like, what are the requirements? Where do you think it's going to be in 5 years?
Right. Right.
It's just hard. This is why software development's so hard.
Yeah.
Gluing APIs together is easy.
Yeah.
Picking the technology that you're going to use to glue those APIs is the hard part.
Yes. Yes. And I just wonder what other people who have been building SPAs for as long as we have would say. Would they say they feel like they're using the most productive tools in the world, or would they say the promises haven't been delivered yet? Obviously, it's not to say there's nothing great about it. Everyone's going to have great things to say about their tech stack. It's the reason they use it. But there's also, can you see the downsides of it? And can you see where the promises haven't been delivered yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, just the reality of an SPA is you don't control the back end, you don't control the database, so you can't introspect the way Rails Form 4 can. I'm sure, Laravel has something similar. You can just get a form with validations really quick. And you just can't do that with an SPA without making more assumptions.
Yeah. I guess going back to, this was a nice thing, but going back to us saying we think every app should be an Ember app, or really it's like every app should be an SPA.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I think this, what you just said is like, can you get here? I think, yeah, the reason we think every app should be an SPA is because we think that trade-off curve can be bent.
Right.
And you can have a UI with validations that works all the way.
Right.
All the way up to the database,
Right.
So.
Right. And those constraints can help. They don't have to be, you don't have to have a maximally flexible API. You can, if you did have something like JSON API with its rough edges sanded, it could serve every app in the same way like Rails only needs resourceful controllers. and it forces you to think in the constraints, but it lets you move faster once you understand how to think in that way.
Yes. But yes, yeah, totally. And you can build on top of add-ons.
Right.
And stuff like that. Right. So yes.
Right. Exactly. It's just today there's a lot of incidental complexity. And I wonder if, I also wonder, like, it's been many years and there's still, yeah, again, the user form thing with the session, with the auth and a validated form. I wonder if add-ons and third-party communities can only do so much. You need the first-party solution to step up and provide an answer that everyone's just going to get on board. You're either on the bus or you're off the bus. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, one of the great things about Rails is very, we're going to do it like this.
Yeah.
And if you don't do it, you're fighting the framework and making your life miserable.
Right.
It's not.
And you don't have the right to complain about that,
right,
basically.
Right. It's not. What has DHH said? It's like, I don't care if I leave people behind. Didn't he say something like that?
He said, he said that we're not really interested in taking time to teach people who are not going to take time to learn how to do it our way, because that's who we're making the framework for.
Yep.
Is people who are totally bought into our vision and our methodology approach to writing apps like this. And so if you have taken the time to buy into that, you've drank the Kool-Aid and now you're having problems, we're going to help you. But if you're complaining that Rails is not a good API layer for Ember, then I don't care about that, because I don't think you should be using Ember I don't think you should be using an SPA or whatever.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And then, you know, 5 years later, begrudgingly, someone gets a --- API option into Rails new, and he's just like, whatever.
I think that might be gone now.
Really?
Yeah. I think Rails API is a thing of the past.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I don't know someone that's more familiar with Rails, but I think that's like a dead project now.
Yeah. Interesting. So. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Left behind.
I, as someone that, you know, builds a lot of web apps, that's kind of the thing that I want. I want just someone
who is aligned with what you're going for.
And just tells me
what to do.
How to do validations. And right. I'll, you know, I don't really want a bike shed. If someone asked me for my opinion on how to do validations, I would talk for hours. This is how I do it. This is what works. This is what doesn't. But if someone came along and contradicted that, but said, you know, I'm going to build the framework that supports.
Yep.
I would say, okay, I can change my mind.
That's really interesting. You know, that I think actually you just hit at why I thought this was important to talk about in the beginning, which is like why when people start talking about functional types as a low level way to manage state, I don't really care that much. But when people show me Form4 and Rails, I'm like super FOMOing. You know, and this is like a way, what you just said is a way to get at like, what is the underserved market here? And, you know, GraphQL is awesome, but I want the thing that's going to be built on top of GraphQL. So I don't ever have to think about my API again. And it's the same for a lot of this stuff. And, there's people who like to nerd out about the details and want to bike shed, not in a bad way, but bike shed because they have strong opinions about those implementation details. But I want what it enables. And it's like, you feel, if you agree with what we're saying right now, then you probably feel underserved right now, because I don't want 10 different choices for a state solution or whatever. I just want to be able to undo in my app. I want to be able to write a form fast. I don't want maximum flexibility. I want the opposite, actually. Yeah.
Going back to your joke about us becoming PHP developers, if Ember said, listen, we're only going to work with PHP. We have all these like backend PHP libraries.
That's the thing.
To communicate with your Ember data store, and just boom, you like set this up and your Ember data store just reads from your database. And there's this middle PHP layer. We would do it.
Not if we had to write a lot of PHP, but the idea there would be like, if you were serving this market correctly, you actually would just be using like this DSL that happens to be written in PHP, but it's basically abstracting. Basically, it would have to abstract away like 5 to 10x as much Rails code as we write right now, but we would switch to it. Yeah. If there was something that we could switch to, because we see Rails as like an implementation detail of our Ember app, and like we don't really care about it that much in a sense.
Yes.
It's like, what's the best tool for that? So I have to think about it as little as possible. I want to think about the design. I want to think about the UX, the animations, all that stuff.
Yeah, I want to think about how the quickest way to solve this problem correctly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't care even about, totally. So it's interesting because, as we break these things apart, and it's like, it's, again, there is some validity to people who are like, everyone's making things too abstract and complicated these days. But it's like, no, one counter to that is like, the fact that we've separated, you know, the front end, the back end, a database. We have this clean separation, lets us identify what can be commoditized and what is the stuff that we really care about still. And then so you find out, like, even HTML and CSS could be commoditized in the sense that it could be abstracted away. I don't care about writing HTML and CSS. I want a button. Like, if you gave me a design library, if I could, like, drag and drop buttons and link up tables, then see ya. Like, I have a lot of knowledge about HTML and CSS, but that's a means to an end of making a product.
Yep.
If you gave me a Squarespace, I could do that stuff, then I would happily abstract that stuff out of my tool set. And I think there's a lot of people like that who are just wanting to use a tool as primarily a means to an end. And
some people might be freaking out about ditching HTML and having to use Squarespace. But I would say most people are like that because, you know, if you look at the history of web apps, we keep building on top of abstractions.
Right.
How many people worry about TCP today?
Exactly.
No one's like, oh, I like TCP. But there was a time.
Yeah,
there was a time where it's like...
Same way people would say, no, you have to. You can never abstract away. You have to know the difference
between TCP and UDP. Yes. Today, what?
Yeah, exactly. And today people will say, you can't build a front end. I've heard people say this before. I don't like the distinction between front end and back end developer because a front end person who doesn't understand the data and how it's moving... you're just introducing debt, basically. Like, those things can't be abstracted right now. You have to understand everything or else you're just you're kidding yourself. And okay, maybe that's actually true today, but I believe in a future where that's not actually true, where I don't actually care. I never open the network tab ever again, ever. I never look at the shape of the data.
I agree with you. I mean, it's definitely true today.
It's definitely
true
today.
You have to,
but yes. But you want a future. And that's the question. Who's working towards that? Who are the people who are working towards the elimination of that part of the developer's tool set? I think that's an interesting way to ask the question. Dude, Code Sandbox is moving us to a world where I never have to type in ls or npm install ever again. That to me is super exciting. I would love for those things to be abstracted away from my sandbox. It's from my toolkit.
I mean, I guess
never have to learn how to use Node or Path or anything like that again. I just open up a browser and I have my environment there set up.
I guess it's all the people that are making services for all the stuff we're talking about, like a log auth service and a
Firebase,
payment service,
Stripe.
And Firebase.
Yep, that's true.
And so it's just,
I think those people are going to win because I think the people who say that you should not use those are the same people who say you should write your own SQL. And those people, I think, are losing in a sense.
Right now, these things are really expensive and you can get locked into a bad abstraction and you know, that's super expensive, but these will become commoditized. The price is going to just drop to nothing.
Yep.
And so, yeah.
Totally agree. I welcome our future. I welcome our automatic serviceful future. So maybe we can just end on one more topic. I was working on Mirage last week or two. And I have a note here. What happens when users come to rely on undocumented behavior for your library? Makes improving the lib harder. You now have to support these users and this incorrect behavior. Tactics for avoiding. So this is tough.
Dangerously set in our HTML.
But what about this? Someone imports something from add-on slash. So like, you know, in Ember href 2? You know Ember href 2?
Yes.
The use case there, the public API there is actually like an href2 helper in handlebars. Yep. But it's super useful to be able to get the string URL for a given arg list of model of route name and models. So people import the thing from add-on slash and call the function on it.
Oh, in like JavaScript.
Yes.
Land.
Yes. I think we even maybe have done that before.
Probably. I mean, I would totally do that.
But then think about it from the maintainer's perspective. You're like, wait, now I can't change anything in add-on.
So you're saying not only like not change anything, but like even you just have these files, these import paths.
Yeah, it's just there exactly. Forever. People are now coming to depend on that. And this was like a big problem in Ember Data over the year was just the fact that there's a lot of behavior that was undocumented or not even known and came to be relied upon. And so when the library tried to change, it was breaking things in ways that the maintainers didn't even understand. And this happened to me in Mirage in the last few weeks. There's like this, Mirage has like a helper, normalized adders, and so in Mirage, you have a shorthand, right? Like get users and it's going to do the right thing. But if you want to drop down and write your own custom route handler, you can say post users. And then in the post shorthand handler will look at the URL like for slash users and then back out the name of the model that it's working with, user, and then get the attributes from the request and then create a new user model and return that. And then this does that as a shorthand. If you want to, it decomposes into a route handler where you can pass a function and you can use this helper called normalized request adders. And you type this.normalized request adders and that does all that magic for you. But then you can do whatever you want with those adders, like add assertions or whatever. So someone had an issue where they had a route that was like post slash user slash create. And the way the normalized request adders things work is looking at the URL. So the assumption when I created that functionality was that the way this works is if you're using a conventional URL, which would be slash users, and you send a post request to it, we're going to back out the name of the model from the user, or you can pass in the name of the model as a second argument to the shorthand. But if you're using a conventional thing, that should work. So this person had slash user slash create and was using normalized request adders. Now, so request adders was looking at the slash create, the trailing part of the URL, and so thinking the model name was create.
Did they wrap everything in like a create pojo? Pojo with a key create?
But something was, it was working still. It still worked in an unintended way because the actual serializer they were using didn't ever have the name of the model. So everything was working. And then I was going and fixing and improving this other bug. And part of what I did to fix that bug and improve the messaging was make sure that request normalized request adders was actually valid. And it was when it was discovering the model name, it was doing it correct. And if it didn't, it's going to say you're either using a shorthand or normalized request adders and you're trying to access a create model, but that doesn't exist.
So why did it work?
It didn't actually use.
Why did slash user slash create work?
Because he got normalized request adders, which returned the attributes and didn't actually need the model name. And then he himself called users.create.
I see.
But this code path was used by other parts of Mirage. And so I wanted to improve it and fix this other bug. So then I published 4.10. He upgrades from 4.9 to 4.10. And his route handler doesn't work anymore. So it just doesn't work. He gets there and he hits an assertion that's like, you're trying to access, you're either using a shorthand or normalized request adders, and you're trying to access a create model, but that doesn't exist. Make sure to check your thing. So this is just one, this actually happened like three, there's like three other times this happened.
I mean, hold on. This is like every software bug too. Like you can't write bug-free code. Bugs are going to come up.
It's not about the bugs though. It's about, as a maintainer, how do you know how people are using your library? And how do you expose APIs in a way that is constrained enough that you know how they're... Basically, there's no way that... People didn't even know this, how this was meant to be used. This also happened with like server.create. People have been doing server.create users. And it was intended to be server.create user.
But
and
server, it just happened to work
for a long time because like maybe somewhere in the code path I was calling singularize or whatever. But then, again, this was causing bugs somewhere else. So I went to fix it. And then all of a sudden people are like, I just upgraded from like 0.47 to 0.410 and my app broke. If you're going to break, we should pump the miner. I'm like, this is not meant to be a breaking change. This was meant to be a bug fix. But you're changing undocumented behavior. Right, yeah. How could they have known even? I realize this. You look at it. I mean, there's examples where it's singular, but there's a lot in a maintainer's head, the author's head, about how this thing is intended to be used. And you can communicate that in talks or docs, and you can communicate that with like types in your actual API. But there's lots of opportunities for people to use your things in a way that you don't expect.
Totally.
Lots.
Totally. And just even if your code is bug free, there's ways they can use it.
Exactly.
But also once you introduce a bug, there might be some unexpected behavior that they rely on. You know, I think like an answer here is like you want just like really easy ways to communicate.
Yeah.
So things like GitHub issues, code sandbox, mm-hmm. like being able to replicate this stuff.
But like, I was even thinking like, what are some tactics that you can use to help avoid this stuff from ever happening? So if I'm creating an API, and like this has come up a lot in Mirage and also a lot in Ember Data because of like the model name conventions for compound names. Do you hyphenate? Do you camel case? Do you pluralize? Do you singularize? This stuff comes up tons. So it's like, I want to do a thing where it's like server.create, and it's intended to be used as the single case thing. And if you ever pass a non-single case, non-singularized version, you like throw an error from the beginning.
Yeah, I was going to say the place where this always bites me is where whenever I write a function that like, oh, it could take a string,
yeah,
or it could take an object. And then I just have some like if statement at the top of the function that figures out, is it a string or is it an object? Yes. And then like convert it to what I really want. Every time I write that code, it comes back to bite me.
Yes.
It makes it hard to refactor. So yeah, like just, yeah, super simple
super
APIs.
But like, I mean, I think types could help here. You can imagine we have like model name and type and collection name in Mirage. Ember Data also has like model name and type and like constructor, whatever. There are different versions, like is it hyphenated? Is it camel case? When it's a string, how do you refer to it? When it's a property on a JavaScript object, how do you refer to it? You kind of want like type information here, I think.
Sure. But when you say types, I just look at those. It's all like, those are all strings.
But maybe you could have some like
validation on those.
Yeah.
The thing is like, I just don't think you can ever... I think you're saying I could have prevented this, and then I'm gonna get upset when these things get reported.
Yeah,
I don't think you can ever prevent this. I think there's always gonna be, and also giving your users aren't intentionally trying to break your code.
Absolutely not.
You're giving them the best intention,
but it gets you as a library maintainer in a really tricky spot. I mean, again, look at what happened with Ember Data. There was just stuff that people are using. We're using Ember Data in ways that, that originally they didn't intend because of the way we do things.
Like we ran into problems and that was the best way to fix it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
But then you come to rely on that behavior and it makes it really hard for them to improve it. So it's almost like you want, you just want more constraints. I want more constraints. I want to be able to say like, what is the APIs of Mirage? And it's like, you call this function and that's it. And if you like happen to call it, you know what I'm saying? It's hard to know, but I do think... In the same, I mean, now that I'm thinking about this, like when I'm writing these methods and stuff, like thinking about 1.0 and stuff, ways to improve this, like I'll be much more intelligent about it. And like if you're using a method and passing the wrong kind of information, like I'll at least warn you. So, but I mean, I think as someone who, when I was starting Mirage or others who are starting libraries or writing libraries, thinking about this is really important. But I would like to surface, because I think, in the same way that I'm discovering ways of doing it in Mirage, I think if we talk to other people who are in the situation, they will have thought of lots of ways to constrain the use of their library to minimize the likelihood that it's used in unexpected ways. So I'd like to kind of raise that question in the community and just see what people say.
You know, like also too, I might be focusing too much on like this specific normalized request headers, but like, could you do something where it's like, okay, like there can be an abstraction here where you can import like legacy normalized request adders. It can get the old function somehow.
Yeah. So in terms of an upgrade path, once you discover the problem, I think Ember, the community, has discovered like good ways of doing it with the deprecation. So what I did in this case was publish a 4.11, reverting the old behavior, or doing it in a way that fixed the original bug, but then preserves the old behavior. But now I just have an if, and if you're using the old behavior, I'll support it and throw a warning. And that way I can just tell people, go to the last version of 4x, run your test suite, and if you never see a warning, you can go to 5 and the old behavior will be moved. So like, I think the deprecation workflow is correct.
Okay. I think that is your best answer.
No, but there's a better answer, because if I was going to add a new feature in the future, a new API in the future, and I'm going to be, you bet your bottom dollar, I'll be thinking about this, and I'm going to think about making sure if you just take a string, I'm not going to call like camelize and singularize willy-nilly on it. I'm going to do some validation.
Sure, but you're still going to add some function after this conversation, and it's going to be used in an unintended way.
Absolutely, but so, you want to minimize the chance of that. And you want to minimize the chance of that. And you want to get good test coverage around stuff too. So there's times where I would add stuff. Oh yeah, we can do that. And then maybe you don't add test coverage. I mean, I add a lot of tests in Mirage, but like maybe there's a time where you think someone opens a PR and you think, yeah, you just have to think about this.
Yeah.
This is another thing you have to think about. It's the same thing with the add-on case. Like if I put something in add-on and make it available to your Ember app, it's now importable and people can use that. And I can tell them not to, but it'd be much easier in the future if I can keep things truly private. It's public interface.
Yeah.
You want to keep a small public interface because it gives you way more flexibility in the future.
Yes.
You don't want people opening issues saying, shoot, I imported that in my app and now I can't do it.
hey,
you would rather avoid that in the future.
You know, how like in Ember Data Mirage, there's a whole bunch of way to represent models.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. Strings, whatever, objects.
Yep. Identifiers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Camel case.
Maybe it's just you're talking about test cases. Maybe it's like you're adding a new thing and you're just like, you get in the mindset of like, I should write test cases for all the ways.
Well, that's what I've started doing. Compound names. That's a big thing too. There's lots of bugs in early Mirage where it's like you're writing tests with user and post, but you really want like, fine author and some comment. Make sure there's two names, a fine author instead of an author. So you are testing also the compound name stuff because that just comes to bite you. So,
I know like it's very easy for me to... Monday morning quarterback right. this because I'm not the one maintaining
right.
the library. I think I just can't imagine a world where you prevent this. So it's like, no, what happens when this happens?
I think it's just, the way we've approached like storefront and stuff, it's like go slower and like have one API that solves a problem and try to think about every way it's going to be used and constrain it and test every use of it and make sure we're not, if someone asks for something and it's an quote easy thing to add, but then you've just widened your problem space by a bunch, you are increasing the chance that someone's going to start using it in a way that you don't really understand or expect. So,
That's a great point because with Storefront, we get feature requests about relationships
right.
all the time. And it's not easy, but it is doable. But I have just a default, like, no, this is too hard
right.
because it looks simple, but it totally expands the problem space.
Right.
And it's going to be something we can't maintain. So.
Right, exactly. So, I just thought that was interesting. And it was just, I've been on the other side where you do a minor version upgrade. You do a minor version upgrade of a library and you're sitting there doing your thing and it shouldn't be breaking anything. And then it breaks something. And you're like, why did someone literally said this to me in the Mirage issues. They're like, why did you change this and then release a patch version? Like, this should absolutely not have been a patch version. And he was looking at the diff, the commit, and saying like, this is behavior I rely on. You just changed it and published like a patch version. I was like, I didn't know people were using it like this. I need your help to understand. Because there's no test that broke. That's the thing, right? Mm-hmm. That there's no test that broke from this version to the last. So from my perspective as the maintainer, I didn't break anything. This wasn't a breaking change from my knowledge. But in fact, I can look at this, understand your situation, and realize it was a breaking change. So what we need is to actually document that behavior and cover it with tests so that if it's broken, we get a failing test. That's the only way we can know. I've been on both sides of that, right? And I think sometimes... Again, it's an example where, let's say Ember Data changes what happens when you do like pcall or something. And we're like, how could they change that? We use this all the time. But then having been in the other shoes this time, it's very, very easy. Much easier than you think as someone who's intimately familiar with this one part of the library that you rely on and have it change. It's much easier for you to see that and understand why that was like a breaking change. Whereas a maintainer is thinking about the general problem space and all of the use cases and has to rely on the test suite because they can't keep everything in their head. And if you don't have a behavior that people rely on covered in the test suite, you're just done. There's no chance. So, I just thought that was interesting to be on the other side of that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think like, to me, this isn't like it's almost like a community problem where it's like, you want like this like super low barrier. You don't want someone to ever open an issue that's like, why the hell did you change that?
I know, but it's just because we're talking about this right now. If we were upgrading something and we did a minor upgrade of something and it broke something in what seemed like an egregious way, we'd be like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
Like we would be very frustrated. It would be very upsetting and frustrating.
Right.
It would be frustrating.
It would be. But I also feel like if it was like something Ember related, we would have a path to
communicate.
We would look up who did it. We probably know them. We could
just
send them a message. We could open a GitHub issue. I probably wouldn't try to recreate it. I don't know, maybe I'd do like a failing test.
Yeah.
There's not as much friction where if like, I don't know, something with Node broke, that would be like, what the? Because I don't have like an outlet. I feel like I'm just stuck.
Yep.
So.
Totally. Cool. Just to bring it back to like a lot of the trickier Mirage bugs are solved. So we're really close to 1.0 now. The big things are... pretender and faker, making them like peer dependencies or whatever the right step is there for people to be able to update this. It's actually something I want to talk to Adam about, because like we have like Ember CLI Tailwind that depends on Tailwind. So how do you go about that? Like, are peer dependencies, how are other people making libraries that depend on Tailwind doing that? Because that's the same situation that Mirage is in relative to pretender, faker, or these other things.
I think I saw Ed on Discuss say, like, if I really liked what he said, it made it clear for me, at least. It was, if like you import the thing into your app, mm-hmm. then it's a peer dependency. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if that's kind of true with faker.
It is because, true. Yes.
But yep. With pretender, is that true with pretender? Like do people?
No, not okay. really. No. But there are no. But this is the situation. Is that there are times where people reasonably want to be able to change their pretender version without upgrading Mirage, or without having to wait for Mirage to upgrade pretender. So they do, meaning in a sense they are importing it, in the sense that they meaningfully care about which version of pretender. Yeah. It's not purely an implementation detail of Mirage in that case.
This I ran into this a few months ago with add-on docs and storefront, mm-hmm. but Yarn has resolutions mm-hmm. built into it which nicely solve this, but one of the issues I ran into is it's like a Yarn only thing,
right?
And it's NPM doesn't support right. it, and some people have tried to like monkey patch require to have like resolution support, so when you require it, like looks up a different thing based on your resolution, but that's when you're writing an Ember app and you're never like thinking about how things get required, right. that's too hard,
right right.
So yeah, hopefully tooling gets better for that. I mean, yeah, as someone that ran into this and realized I was getting the wrong version of a dependency yes. for like 3 months.
Yes. Pretty bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that I need to figure that out, but that'll be good to have a pattern for that and for all of our libraries going forward. And then also just, we've been talking about writing a blog post on this soon, or even making a video, but just some best practices that we've come to adopt for maintaining open source, and just some little things that are so helpful. You know, I think we talked about this in an earlier episode, where you have like a bug label, and that helps. And what I've realized now is you actually want two labels. You want like a needs reproduction, and you want like a reproducible bug. So you want like a bug label, but you also want a bug report or / needs reproduction. And so again, just as a way to communicate with people, because as a maintainer, someone opens something and then, you know, a day later they say, never mind, it was because I hadn't cleared my NPM cache, but you don't want to waste time on that. And it's totally reasonable for you not to want to waste time on that. So someone opens an issue that's a bug report, you say bug report and say, make it easy for them to create a reproduction. Either a failing test is ideal, or a repo that you can check out that demonstrates the bug. And just that would let you go through. And then, you know, just if I had just known all this a year or two ago, and I could have gone through the 100 issues and done either a feature request, reproducible bug, or needs reproduction, and then just focus on the reproducible bugs first, that just would have helped the momentum so much.
Yeah. Yeah, I can hugely relate to that. Especially with like storefront, people will open issues, and as a maintainer of the library,
you don't want to sit there. Don't want to just sit there and be like, what do I do with this?
Well, also too, it's like the maintainer of the library, when they open an issue saying like X doesn't work
right.
in Y situation, you immediately start thinking like, why doesn't that work?
Right.
And there's just a lot of assumptions
right.
that you're thinking about, that they're thinking about. And then, yeah, you can just spend hours, right. hours on that. Right. Where if there's an actual reproducible bug,
right.
it's like, there's no assumptions. You're right. not going to assume what they were thinking. They're not going to assume. Yeah,
totally.
So yes, that
hard won lesson.
Yes.
Cool. Shall we wrap it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Show notes. Where can people find show notes?
embermap.com/podcast.
We have a podcast.
Oh,
page.
That's right. Brand new pod. It looks beautiful.
Yeah, it's cool. It's fast booted. We'll have to talk about that fast boot bug next time that Tom pointed out. I never asked you about that.
Oh, yeah. That's a fun one.
The invalid HTML.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about that. But it is fast booted. It's fast. It looks cool. It works, as far as I can tell. If it doesn't work, let us know. But yeah, check us out. embermap.com/podcast. If you like the podcast, and you want other people to hear about it, best way is to rate us on iTunes. So that'll help other people find the show. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.